This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the SportsMap Radio Network.
Presented by Rocket Mortgage. When you need certainty in the home buying process with a loan that fits your life, Rocket can.
Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios, alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
And a good Thursday morning to you. Yeah, and it's a throwback Thursday again, and we got an oldie but goodie coming your way on the show today. Last week, I think I burst the bubble of people who kind of are hoping that one day time travel would be possible by saying that because the galaxy is moving across space, that going back and being in the exact location that you were 15 years ago is kind of impossible. But let's say there is a way in the future to go back in time, hypothetically. This basketball tournament is a perfect example of what you would not do if you went back in time with the Gray's Farmer's Sports Almanac. Look at this tournament and look how many surprises have occurred. We talked about this earlier in the week, right? There were 12 what they call upsets in the tournament officially, a five-seed difference. You've got a Sweet 16 and includes an Oral Roberts team. You've got Loyola Chicago that beat Illinois. You got UCLA in the Sweet 16 that had to go through the play-in game in order to get there, right? We've got all sorts of these kind of teams. Yes, we still have Baylor. Yes, we still have Michigan. And, of course, we still have Gonzaga. But if you're going to go back in time, do not start throwing a whole bunch of money on Oral Roberts. Do not start throwing all sorts of money on Loyola Chicago. Because the moment that these things start kicking in and you keep being successful, like Biff in Back to the Future, believe me, somebody's going to wonder what happened. If you have a perfect bracket right now, you are a time traveler. You are either a time traveler or you're channeling in some psychic ability. So just my advice, in the future, when they do invent this machine to go back in time, you know, play some games that are just like, wow, I really never saw that coming. I really took a bath, while you make money on the other games down the line. This is going to be a fun Sweet 16. It was supposed to start today. It is not. It's going to be moved, obviously, for COVID to the weekend. Look, in the end, do I think the top seeds, you know, we're going to have more and more single-digit seeds? Of course, because that's really how this goes. But to continue the story of Oral Roberts and Loyola Chicago and Sister Jean and even UCLA's journey and all of the Syracuse's zone, all of these things that are going to start on Saturday and into Sunday, you know, it's still, despite the fact that it's not today, I'm still looking forward to see how those stories continue, even if they end over the weekend. It's Wake Up Call.
A throwback Thursday on Wake Up Call. Now back to the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios with Tony D and Ron Culver.
Well, the internet is a fantastic thing, isn't it? We go back to 1934 today. This was probably playing on the old music box back in the day.
On
what
the,
happened?
Victor, what are these called? Victorola?
Victorola, yeah. Exactly. Play that record. On this date, the final round of the 1934 Masters. It's not just any Masters. It was the first Masters. And it was won by Horton Smith, beating Craig Wood by one shot. Interesting thing about this tournament, first one ever, Bobby Jones basically inviting his friends, some of the best golfers in the world, to participate in his tournament in Augusta, is that when you watch the Masters today, and they say the big famous line, the Masters doesn't start until the back nine on Sunday, well, the back nine at this Masters was actually the front nine, and it concluded on hole nine at Augusta. And then the next year they went, oh, this is silly, let's just change it. So they changed it. So this is the first and only Masters that was ever played with the first hole being what is the 10th, that downhill to the right par 4. And then, of course, you've got the 12th over the river and then the par 5 13th. That was all on the front nine. So and he won the tournament finishing, it was like 4 under par, which is I've always wanted to know. Golf, like, I would have loved to have attended, like, knowing what I know about golf now, I would love to have attended an event in the 30s. Like, what were they hitting? Like, these wooden clubs with these balls? Yeah. Like, what, like, how do you even make a birdie on a 1930s golf course?
I mean, they were all woods, right?
Yeah, they were wooden shafts and, yeah, I mean, it was all, Like, it was crazy. It's crazy the amount of talent. Like, we look at the game today, and it's all about technology. Sure, it's all talent. It's still talent. Don't get me wrong. But the ball goes further. The clubs have got titanium shafts now, and they're all scientifically designed, and we're lasering everything. And, I mean, fitting these guys. These guys like Billy Burke and Paul Runyon, you got to, give me a stick. Here's the ball. Let me hit it. And hitting it accurately to the flag stick. Putting on greens that are not silky smooth.
So Right? Here's the question then. Who do you think would have an easier time? If we took a golfer now and put him back then to play with those clubs, or bringing a golfer from then and having him play with the clubs of today?
That's an interesting conversation, because I don't know if you grew up with all of the latest technology, how long it would take you to adapt your game to a different kind of ball and the wooden shafts. But if you took Bobby Jones and threw him here and said, "Hey, take a week to work on," he'd probably be like, "Oh God, yes, yes." He's probably slamming it 300 yards.
Well, because it's got to be lighter.
Yes, right. His swing was pure as silk.
But maybe then he's overswinging,
right?
Because
that's true.
The club is so light.
Maybe so. But if you know, you're right. If you gave both sets of golfers and you said, "Take a week or 2 weeks on that equipment, practice as long as you want," I don't know. It might be even money, but. I mean, when I look at the yardage, when I was looking this up yesterday, I was looking at the yardage, and the golf course in 1934 played to 6,700 yards, which is still longer than most of the public courses. Like, if you go out and play at the regular tee box at your local public course, this course is still longer than that. And you're playing with better equipment than Bobby Jones did. So, you know, they're birdieing 420-yard par fours. I mean, that's wild. I don't know. They probably hit it 240 off the tee. Maybe 250, maybe. So the first Masters on this date, again, 1934. So you're going to hear some really groovy music on the show today.
Can we call it? I don't know if it's groovy.
I don't know if it's groovy. I don't know how best to describe it. To be
I don't
honest.
Think there's a whole lot of singing.
No, I don't think so either.
You're going to have a lot of instrumentals today.
There's a story breaking out of, not really breaking, but it's out of Oklahoma. Lincoln Riley met with reporters yesterday. He's got an interesting situation, and it's kind of one, there's a larger issue at play here. Chandler Morris was a quarterback for the Sooners, and he transferred to TCU. And Riley and the Sooners are not granting him permission to play immediately. Now, he's at TCU. They're not keeping him at Oklahoma. But they do have the right to say, no, he can't play the second he gets there. And they're doing this so he cannot play next year at TCU. After that, he can play for TCU, but not right away. And there's a changing landscape of college athletics right now, right? We're seeing more players' rights. We're seeing more empowerment of players. We're seeing the transfer portal being used. It's, you know, players used to have to sit out a year. Now you don't necessarily have to. But this rule is still in place, meaning that an interconference transfer. Well, to be honest with you, I think you can prevent anybody from playing immediately. But for the most part, interconference transfers are being held because Riley says it's bad for the game, and that's why he's doing it. He likes transferring. He says it's okay to transfer. He likes the ease of which students can do that now. But he is not in favor of if you go to a team within our conference, you shouldn't play right away. And he believes it because this quarterback in particular, or any position player, has sat in meetings, learns the game plan, learns the playbook, learns everything about your program for a year, 2 years, however long they're there, and then they jump ship, go to a conference opponent, and then they can spill the beans on everything that you do. As a program, everything you believe in as a program, everything that you're, all of your philosophies, all of your plays, all of it, whatever it is that you have that you want to keep secret. So Riley thinks it's bad for college football if this happens. Now, he has granted permission for players to play in other conferences. He had a player that went to the Pac-12. He had no problem with it. Play right away. We don't play you. But we do play TCU, so we're not going to do this. When I heard Lincoln Riley speak about this, my first thought was, well, you know what? He does have a point. Right? I mean, they're trying to keep things secret. They're trying to keep things, you know, under wraps as best they can. You can have players showing up for a year and then venturing off to play for your opponent in future games. But I hate to say it like this for Lincoln Riley and the rest of his like, the wave of change is coming, and it's coming strong, and you're going to get caught up in it if you hang on to these sort of beliefs. Like, Lincoln Riley is screaming into a raging storm, and no one can hear him. That's basically what's happening. The wave of animosity that came his way on this was pretty big. There were some sympathizers to what he was saying, but it's an outdated look at where college athletics is heading right now. He's trying to stand up for this sort of level of integrity where it doesn't fit in his own profession, right? Coaches can leave and go to other schools, and they do it all the time. If he has an assistant coach right now that can make more money at Texas, that person is allowed to quit that job and go coach at Texas. But a player can't play for one full year, which in some cases, not all, but some, could ruin their opportunity at staying with the scholarship. Lincoln Riley is a young man, a young coach, but he has antiquated ideas on the business of coaching. This sort of belief now that players are taking full advantage of what's coming their way, you're going to be left behind as a coach if you're still grabbing on to things, even if they make sense. And let me be honest with you. His argument makes sense. You spend a lot of time as a head coach putting in your game plan, putting in plays that work, putting in a philosophy, getting a system in place, all of those things. Yeah, you don't want it thwarted by some disgruntled kid who's not playing and wants to play and is just going to go to your rival. And in 4 to 6 months, he's telling everybody in the coaching room all about the things that you've been discussing in your team meetings. I mean, he could be there 2 years and really know your system. I understand it, but we're not going back with players' rights. They're getting more and more. They have a bigger understanding of where they really are in the scheme of things. And I think in the end, the Big 12's stance on this is, if the NCAA allows us to do this, meaning halting the eligibility, the immediate eligibility of a transfer within the conference, then we're gonna do that. When the NCAA says that's not allowed, that the player gets to play immediately, we will acquiesce and we will go about that. We will just let it happen. Lincoln Riley said that. And he says, well, down the road, if things change, there'll be nothing I can do about it. But while I'm here and while we can do something about it, we don't want him playing for TCU right now. We wish him well. We actually like him. Now, Chandler Morris is the son of former SMU and Arkansas coach Chad Morris. And he just wasn't being able to play. Spencer Rattler is the Sooner quarterback. They also got a young kid that they brought on board. He's unlikely to play. But Oklahoma, and to their credit, I mean, they brought in Baker Mayfield. They brought in Jalen Hurts, right? They brought in Kyler Murray. But outside of Hurts, who was a graduate transfer, the other two sat out a full year before playing for Lincoln Riley and the Sooners. So I understand where he's coming from, but man, we've been discussing, especially with the college basketball tournament, and I got another thing I'm going to get to later on in the show about where college sports could be heading and why we're not modeling amateur sports or the rise to the professional level like we see in other countries. But when I hear a coach, and I don't care if it's Nick Saban or James Franklin, who I like a lot, or Lincoln Riley, when I hear them talk about things that they're holding on to during this wave of rights and the wave of the way college athletics is going, leaning to the player's favor, again, it's screaming in a storm and nobody can hear. I mean, we haven't even got image and likeness in the system yet, and I can only imagine the headache that's going to cause these guys. Like, seriously, if Lincoln Riley's going to stand on a soapbox for this issue, oh, wait till players can start making some cash and really start dictating their recruiting and the angles and everything that they can take advantage of. Wait till that Pandora's box opens up. These coaches are going to scream and cry into their $8 million salaries. All right, coming up next, we don't get into hockey much, but boy, was there a controversy in the Predators-Red Wings game from the other night. That's coming up next on Wake Up Call.
It's a Throwback Thursday on Wake Up Call. Now back to the O'Reilly Auto Parts studios with Tony D and Ron Culver.
Man, like I said, we're going way back, 1934, folks. We're going back to the first Masters golf tournament at Augusta National that wrapped up on this date with Horton Smith winning by one over Craig Wood. And the Masters would go on to the legendary lore that it is right now. A weak battery could leave you stranded, so don't take a chance. O'Reilly Auto Parts will test that battery free of charge, and if your battery needs to be replaced, their professional parts people can help you find the exact battery that fits your car or truck at a guaranteed low price. Make sure your vehicle is prepared for the weather ahead by getting your battery tested for free at O'Reilly Auto Parts. O'Reilly Auto parts, better prices every day. Yeah, man, you know what's amazing about the Masters? This is one of the things I do have to respect the tournament. Look, I like golf. I play golf. I like watching the majors. But let's be honest, it's not the most exciting sport in the world to watch, right?
No.
You know, and people do find it boring. People do find it a little dull. But yet the Masters draws in a really good audience of people who are like, eh, I don't really like golf, but I'll watch that thing every April. A lot of it is the course, the spring, the flowers, that, you know, a lot of people still getting out of winter in the country, still got some snow on the ground, and maybe that's a little bit it. A lot of it is the pageantry of the golf tournament. It is a big, big event. It's a big deal. But I know a lot of people who don't really, like, who really can't name ten golfers will watch the Masters. They're like, yeah, of course I'll watch the Masters. But maybe it's like Wimbledon. Like, I know people who watch Wimbledon, and they don't know really what's going on in tennis. I mean, they know a few players, but they don't really know. They don't follow it. They're not into it. But the Masters is just like that kind of event.
I just find it amazing that it's the only tournament, especially a major, but the only tournament that's played on the same course year after year after year.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You know, all the other majors, I mean, they rotate. They play here. They'll play there. They're in the East Coast, West Coast, northern part of the United States. But the Masters is right in Augusta every single year.
It's Phil Mickelson has been playing there since like 90, 91, you know, when he was an amateur. And he's been there every year since, and he's won now, so he'll play it until he's, you know, 70 or whatever. But I started thinking, the course, the Masters Golf Tournament, if you qualify for the Masters, okay, so if you are qualified, so if you've won, like if you're Jordan Spieth and you're going to be qualifying forever, you're allowed to show up at any time the course is open and play it.
Yeah.
Anytime. It's closed in the summer, but when it's open, you can. It's not like, oh no, we only reserve the week before. You can show up in December. If the course is open, you can play as many rounds as you want, right? So they're quasi-members. They're not really members, but they're quasi-members. And I was thinking, I don't know what Phil does outside of tournaments, but I'm thinking he's probably played Augusta National more times than I've played rounds of golf in my entire life. And I play golf a lot, but I probably play 10 times a year now and have for the last 20 years. I mean, I don't get out as much as I used to, but I'm thinking from 1990 to now, he's probably played just that golf course more times than I've played golf in my life. Because he probably plays 7, 8, 9, 10 times a year. Practice rounds during the week of the Masters itself, and all the times he jumps on his Gulfstream 4 and flies to Augusta just for a
Sunday
weekend,
afternoon.
For whatever it is that he's like, I'm in Florida, I'm doing this thing, I'm doing this promotional thing on my week off, but you know what? We're going to go to Augusta, play 3 rounds for a couple of days.
See, I always wonder if, you know, if Phil's sitting there in Rancho Santa Fe, California, San Diego, and he just wakes up like on a Saturday morning. He's like, kids are out of the house. Amy has something to do all day. I'm just going to take the jet and go to play Augusta.
Yeah, sure.
I'll be back by dinner.
Oh, no, I read a story once, and I'm going to get into this NHL referee thing, but I read a story once where he was sitting around, literally that exact thing was happening. Amy was doing something, and the kids were all busy, and he said to Bones, You just want to go to England and play the British Open course? Because it was going to be at a new place, Royal Liverpool or something. I wanted one of those places. It was kind of new. He's like, you want to go to England and play? Bones is like, sure. He gets it all set up, flight plan, whatever it is, whatever it takes to get your jet up and running for a trip like that. Packed and left. Flew to England with Bones. They played like four practice rounds at the British Open course a month or so before the tournament and flew back. Spent like 3 days there.
That's a whole different lifestyle.
It's a different lifestyle,
right? You and I will never fully grasp.
I remember once reading Jordan Spieth. He was going to do a promotional event in New York City in the morning. Like he's won the U.S. Open and whatnot. So I think he was doing like a couple of rounds of the radio shows in New York, TV shows in New York, whatever it is. So after it was done, he got to go to Pine Valley, which is in New Jersey. It's literally the number one course in Golf Digest. It's number one course in America. It's not a tour course, but it is fantastic. He played there and then flew to Augusta for the nightcap at Augusta and then had a steak dinner in the clubhouse and then flew home. In one day, he did morning stuff in New York, played Pine Valley, jumped on a jet in the afternoon, flew to Augusta, played Augusta National, flew back to Dallas. And what, on a Tuesday?
Yeah.
It's nuts. What a world. What a life. All right, so this referee in this NHL game, and this is kind of big. It's a big story here in Nashville, but I think it's hilarious. Tim Peel has been a longtime official in the NHL. He started in the league in 1999, was set to retire this year. So the game is between the Predators and the Detroit Red Wings, and Peel makes a call in the game and was caught on a hot mic saying this, quote, "It wasn't much. I just wanted to get a beep penalty against Nashville early." So the NFL, because this is a hot mic, said, "Oh, wait a minute. We're not doing this. Where referees are going to be making calls, dictating the outcome, doing that kind of thing." So they said, "That's it. You're done. You're not working now or in the future." Now, he was set to retire this year, but if he had changed his mind, too bad. It's very likely he will never officiate in the NHL again. And a lot of this is because, and you hear me say it all the time, integrity of the game is literally the most important thing. I'm not kidding. One of the things about these commissioners is they can survive scandals, even criminal scandals, because they can eliminate players, right? So even if your star player in your league is in trouble with the law, you can cut ties with that player and continue on. If your integrity is compromised, if people think that the game is not on the up and up, if it's not square, if there's something manipulating it, then you'll see a lack of ticket sales, you'll see a lack of interest, and people will start questioning whether or not you are legit. And you can't have that. Your sponsors will be compromised, everything. So you always have to make sure that nobody is messing with the integrity of the game. It's why Pete Rose is banned for life, and Steve Howe got 8 chances with all of his drug problems. So the NHL panicked because they believe that this guy was basically manipulating the game. He wanted a call on Nashville early in the game. But there are some people that are actually coming to this guy's defense, even hockey players who are saying, wait, this happens a lot. This happens more than you think. Officials sort of go, hey, I don't want this game to get out of hand. I'm not messing around. We're going to call stuff. It's like an umpire that's like, oh, I usually give an inch off the plate. Then he just shrinks it. You know, he's like, I'm not manipulating the game because I'm not trying to manipulate it to see the outcome. I'm trying to control it a little better. You hear about this in basketball all the time. Let them play. Let them play. A foul is a foul is a foul. There's really no such thing as let them play. Swallow your whistle in the final 2 minutes. Why? Why? If there's a foul, you're supposed to call it. You're not supposed to, as an official, look at the circumstance and go, oh, it's the final 20 seconds. Guys can just headlock each other for all I care. I'm not blowing my whistle. You're supposed to call the game as you see it, regardless of time or place. This official might have been actually doing that. This official, Tim Peel, might have actually been saying, these games with these two teams gets out of hand. There's an aggression level that we don't want. So I'm going to call a penalty on Nashville early, even if it was not much, more of a flop than anything. But I'm going to set the tone. But instead, he's been suspended forever because on a hot mic, I wanted to get a penalty against Nashville early in the game. Yikes.
the Throwback Thursday on Wake Up Call. Now back to the O'Reilly Auto Parts studios with Tony D and Ron Culver.
Oh, the depression. Such good music. 1934 Throwback Thursday first Masters golf tournament wrapped up. Winner took home $1,500. Back then must have been like $1 million.
God.
Earn a $5 rebate by trading up any Gontac thermometer towards an Exergen purchase at any retailer. Accuracy matters when it comes to taking your temperature. And Exergen temporal artery thermometers are backed by more than 80 published peer-reviewed clinical studies. Visit Exergen.com. All right, so this again, back to this referee. I don't know. There's a part of me that's kind of that wonders if he was trying to keep a game under control and is now the scapegoat for a, hey, we're never going to allow this to happen, especially in the age of gambling and bettors. You're not going to be manipulating our games. Maybe he wasn't trying to sway the game in any direction other than keeping the hockey game in check.
Well, I thought he maybe was just making a makeup call. Like he should award he should have awarded a penalty here. We didn't do it, so I'm going to do it here on something that's not as malicious as the one that was before.
Yeah, that could have been it.
I mean, you see that from time to time.
You're not supposed to, but
yeah,
you see
of course.
All, yeah, you see it all the time. See, here's the thing: if they hot mic'd every NBA ref, they'd probably find a whole bunch of reasons to suspend guys.
Well, you wouldn't have an NBA ref.
Yeah,
all of a sudden, be like players, you got to call your own fouls.
I mean, and here's a guy too that like. Again, he's been in the league 20-plus years, set to retire, and this is his exit. His exit is the official that was trying to rig a game. I think it's harsh. I don't think he was trying to rig the game. I don't think he was. I think he really was an official who felt it was his responsibility. And maybe it was that's wrong thinking on his part. But maybe he felt like it was his responsibility to control the game, a makeup call, whatever it is, make sure the players know, hey, we're not messing around here. Like, you guys have been very aggressive. I mean, Detroit-Nashville isn't a rivalry like Chicago-Detroit, but they don't like each other and really haven't for a long time. Maybe he's done a number of those games where he's like, listen, I'm tired of sending 500 people to the penalty box. We're going to make it so that we're going to establish this early so you guys know we're not messing around. But now he's the ref that was rigging hockey games? What do we do? I mean,
yeah, I'd fight it.
That seems bold. It seems like a bold step. Like, the thing was, the NHL didn't even do, like, a real investigation. They just were like, they suspended him almost immediately. This happened Tuesday night. Wednesday, he was suspended. Like, they didn't talk to him. He didn't even get a chance to explain himself because refs aren't allowed to talk to the pool reporters. Right? Like, instead of saying, hey, you know what, let me explain what I was saying here. I may have misconstrued or I said it wrong or it didn't come out the way I intended. But this is really what I meant. Right? But my goodness gracious, I mean, it seemed like a knee-jerk reaction. But you know what's going to happen? And I think this is because once these states started legalizing gambling and you're now partnering up, these leagues are partnering up with gambling sites and gambling advertisers, you really do need to make sure the integrity of your game is intact, that it's protected in some capacity. Because if there is some impropriety that's going on in the game, you're going to try to make a stand to stamp it out, even if it's extreme. Like, instead of sitting this guy down or letting him explain to the public what exactly he meant by this, and maybe it's a reasonable explanation, maybe it's not a reasonable explanation, but we're never going to know. Their knee-jerk reaction is to remind everybody the NHL is on the up and up. Because they're now going to be partnering in with a lot of gambling organizations, legal gambling organizations, and they don't want that relationship strained because the belief, whatever it may be, belief is, all these refs, man, they control these games. They manipulate these games. You can't have that. And so that's what you're going to start seeing more and more of. You know, I remember when I was living in Las Vegas, it was kind of an eye-opening time for me because, you know, I don't know a lot about gambling. I didn't know a lot about gambling when I moved there in my mid-20s. And I learned really quickly, like, how the business works. And I was always kind of believed that, you know, Vegas, they would rig games if they could. You know? And then you get there and you realize it's the exact opposite. If anything, casinos and the sports books in Vegas were protecting the integrity of those sports, of the sports. The guys that do those lines, right? The guys that make those lines, they're pretty good at what they do. They're really good at what they do, actually, because their job, when you create a line on a game, for those who don't know, when you create a line on a game, you're trying to get bets for both sides, right? So a casino wants to take $1 million on one side, $1 million on the other side, and then they use the money that they took from side A, keep a vig for themselves, and then pay the people on side B, right? So you create the line to try to get as even betting as you can. When you hear a sports book lost, it's because they failed at that, right? So if they say, oh, they took a bath at the Super Bowl, it's because the line was missed. Too much money went on one side. They couldn't manipulate the line enough to get money on the other side. So in the end, they take a bath. Sometimes they win a ton. Sometimes they lose a ton. But they're trying to get even money. So a couple of years ago, probably mid-90s, there was a scandal involving Arizona State basketball. And the games were being rigged by the players. The players were point shaving. And the only way people found out about this was Vegas. Because Vegas had lines on Arizona State games, and they started noticing Arizona State kids were betting and betting against the team and, you know, putting way too much money on it. And what happens is that alerts Vegas in a way that makes it go, wait, we know our business. We know an Arizona State game on a Wednesday night in January is going to generate this. All right, plus or minus a few thousand, this is about what an Arizona State game is going to be. When something's really skewed, when you are in the sports book, you're like, wow, that is way too much money that's being played in this Pac-12 basketball game on a Tuesday night, Wednesday night in January, your eyes are opened up. Then it happens again, and then your eyes are really opened up. By the third time, you're pretty much on the phone with the FBI. Going, there's something, we know our business, and this isn't right. And sure enough, they found out there were players getting paid to throw games, make sure the point spread was close, right? Vegas was on the front lines of fighting that, making sure that the games were on the up and up, right? That is what these leagues fear. So you have this official who gets a little mouthy on a hot mic, and boy, how many hot mic got me in trouble stories have we done in the last 6 months? Like, it doesn't matter, like, from that Oklahoma broadcaster to this official, there's a couple of other guys, you get these hot mics, and it's like, whoops. Oh, did I get caught on a hot mic to saying that?
I didn't mean it.
Oh, probably the most famous one was over the summer, just, like, not the summer, but, yeah, I guess it was over the summer when remember Tom Brenneman talking about Kansas City? And the homosexual slur he used?
Yep.
Long time baseball career over.
Yeah.
One hot mic.
In a second.
In a second. That was it. Taken off. Like, he literally said it, too. Didn't he say it in his apology? I'll probably be fired at the end of this.
Yep.
Like, that's it.
Hot mics, and it's always done the same way. You know, suspended and almost in a blink of an eye. Yeah, he was fired. Yeah.
Same thing here. This official's been working in the league 20 plus years. I don't know if they got a pension plan or not or whatever. I don't know. Like, he was heading into retirement.
Yeah. So in a way, it's almost like he was honorably discharged.
Yeah. Bye. Thanks for your service to the league, but see ya. Like, and he's probably, I don't want to speak for him, but he's probably thinking, I didn't say anything on a hot mic that's not said every time I officiate a game amongst us. There has been probably some level of dialogue very similar to what he said on that hot mic that happens every night in the league, where the officials gather and go, yeah, I'm not putting up with this.
Yeah, and it's just a shame that, like you said earlier, it would be nice if he was able to just speak freely.
Yeah.
And just explain his side, because we're only speculating on what he said, you know, what he meant by it. I mean, right. Was he trying to rig a game? We don't know. But, I mean, it's hard for us to believe that he was.
So, yeah, like Colin Campbell, who's the VP of hockey operations, said Tim Peel's conduct is in direct contradiction to the adherence of to the cornerstone principle that we demand of our officials and that our fans, players and coaches and those associated with the game expect and deserve. There's no justification for his comments, no matter the context or his intention. Are you sure about that? Like, are you really sure that the comment he made is an absolute we're going to take it this way and the only way we can take it? I don't know, because we're not hearing from him. We're not hearing from him in a way saying, look, I use this language, but I didn't mean that. Like, okay, look, you're Tom Brenneman, right? And you use that homophobic slur on an open mic. He can't talk his way out of that, right? He used it, right? The guy in Oklahoma who used the N-word in a broadcast and blamed it on, what, having diabetes? Was that?
Yeah,
was that,
blamed right? it on low blamed blood on sugar.
Low blood sugar, right? He tried to explain that, but you can't. You can't. You used those slurs. There's no other way to define your action. You used that language. That language is going to come with repercussions. You can't say, oh, I said the N-word, but I really didn't mean that. No, you said it. You get punished for it. This isn't that. This is the way he talked about that penalty. You could see another side to why he called it. If the NHL is saying, "Oh, this is, we can never stand for an official manipulating the outcome of a game." Do we know that's what he was trying to do? Can the only thing you could defer from his comments was that he was trying to manipulate the score of the game? Here in locally in Nashville, people are like, "Yeah, well, his plans failed because the Predators won 2-0." What do you mean his plans failed? Do we know his plan? Was he trying to give the Red Wings the win? And by how many goals? Were they going to cover the 2.5? What are we talking about here? When we're talking about his diabolical plan was foiled by the hot mic. What diabolical? We can't hear from him. I have no idea. Like, literally, what if he was trying to control the game of two teams that like to beat the crap out of each other every time they're on the ice? Maybe he's like, you know, every time I play these two teams, we've got a game that is so marred in the penalties, I'm going to call some ticky-tack calls here to set the tone. And instead, we can't hear his side of the story because the NHL has already went, that's it, done, wrapped up. He's done. He tried to manipulate the outcome of a game on purpose, diabolically, and we don't want to hear from him. Like, is that where we're going with this? I mean, I feel bad for him. A 20-plus year career, and he's going to be remembered as the guy that tried to rig a hockey game?
Yeah, because, I mean, name another hockey ref.
Right, I know.
But we're going to remember this guy.
We're going to remember this guy. Name a hockey ref. We could play that game all day. John Smith. Hockey ref. No, sorry.
No, try again.
Sorry. He's the special teams coach at Campbell. Oh, okay. All right. On Twitter, at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. That's Ron with two N's. We continue with Wake Up Call.
See them tumbling down.
It's a Throwback Thursday on Wake Up Call. Now back to the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios with Tony D and Ron Culver.
Roy Rogers from 1934 here on Wake Up Call. What other show is going to give you this gem? Now,
Tumbling Tumbleweeds.
We are doing this because of Throwback Thursday. This is not normally how we roll. 1934, the first Masters golf tournament wrapped up at Augusta National. This hour of Wake Up Call presented by Rocket Mortgage. You need a mortgage that fits your life? Rocket can. Won by Horton Smith. The tournament would come to real prominence a year later when Gene Sarazen made a double eagle on the 15th hole at Augusta, which is famously over the water. And that sort of propelled the tournament into what it is today, one of the greatest sporting events all. Look, in this country, we have sporting events that no matter what you feel about the sport in and of itself, we all kind of will watch this, like the Kentucky Derby, Wimbledon, Daytona 500, Indy 500, the Masters. These are all kind of events on the calendar of these other sports you may not watch at all. You may not, like, who watches horse racing outside of the Triple Crown? There are people, but not a lot of people.
And then you even take that and it's extended a step further and go, who watches horse racing outside just one of the legs, Kentucky
sure.
Derby?
I know people who watch the Derby and don't care about the Preakness or the Belmont yep. at all. At all. Same with the Masters. Like, they can say, oh, I love the Masters. Yeah, it was neat when Tiger won. Who won the U.S. Open? I didn't even watch. Oh, okay. Like, I just watched the Masters.
Did they play it yet?
Yeah. I remember when I was a kid, I watched Wimbledon every July. I wasn't a tennis fan, but I watched Wimbledon every July.
Of course.
Right? Boris Becker was winning as a teenager, and Martina Navratilova. And
I remember the first time I watched it was because I watched it for Andre Agassi
yeah.
because of the controversy that he wasn't wanting to wear all white.
That's right. He was the Rebel. Remember the Canon Rebel, yep. the camera?
Yeah.
He advertised for it because he had the crazy hair and the crazy outfits.
And he wasn't going to wear all white at Wimbledon.
No, he wasn't going to do that.
He needed a splash of color.
I'm going to play my game at Wimbledon. So, yeah, so the Masters is very much like those kind of events in our country where, yeah, we get into leagues and we follow the season and we follow the players and an MVP race and the playoff race. But we do have these moments on the calendar where maybe you'll watch the Daytona 500, but you have no idea where they're even going next week. The Masters is, for a lot of people, the Masters is like that. They just go, look, I like the pageantry, but I don't follow golf, but I like this event.